Russian ambassador thought that was the greatest opportunity for communism and Russia to start dealing with the Arab world. See, up to that time, the Arab world was blockaded against Russia. As a matter of fact, the mentioning of Russia favorably by anybody in the Arab world was considered a major crime against the state and against Islam. But now, Nasser told the Arab world that the only friend the Arabs had that would help them in their struggle and in their fight were the Russians. Especially when he said now that the Russians would give us all the things we need and all the arms we want without any strings attached. And that changed the whole look of the Arabs towards the Russians. And the friendship between Nasser and the Arabs started to get stronger. They start signing different cultural friendship, military agreements between Egypt and the Russians. It wasn't that only Egypt, because Egypt entered and justified its friendship with the Russians, now more Arab countries started to sign agreements with the Arabs, like Sudan, later Syria, Yemen, and Iraq, and other Arab countries. By that time, the PLO, which is now a household word in the United States and throughout the world, was very much unknown. As a matter of fact, during all this period, up till the early 60s, there was no really PLO. There were one or two organizations that were always ignored and not even taken seriously by the rest of the Arab world. Until 1962 and 63, when Nasser realized that if he would mobilize the Palestinians and he would patronize them, then he would be able to control them. And this is why he imposed the PLO upon the Arab summit that was meeting in Cairo in 1964. And that was the first time I ever heard about the PLO. And that was in 1964. However, at that time, it was still unknown. It was still undesired by the rest of the Arab world, because they did not want some fighters to be in their own countries, within their own borders, operating. And they could control them at that time. And from 64 to 1967, the PLO fighters were just few hundred people. That's all. And as I mentioned, they were ignored and unknown by the public. And even looked down at by the authorities. However, in 1967, when the Arab-Israeli tension started to really brew, because the Russians threw the rumors in the Arab world that Israel is mobilizing its armies in order to invade Syria. Now, that's all it took for Nasser to start mobilizing his armies at the southern borders of Israel. And when he did that, the situation started to get tense, and it was a tremendously contentious in the Middle East, the situation, that you could feel the tenseness right in the air, especially by the end of May and the beginning of June. He mobilized about 100,000 soldiers at the borders against Israel. And according to previous agreement, he could let the Israeli ships go through the Aqaba Bay. And the Aqaba Bay is dominated by outposts that Egypt had its own or in its own lands. And this is why he said that from now on, no Egyptian, no Israeli ship could pass through the Aqaba Bay. And that's what Israel thought would immediately justify a war, an act of war, because that would cut off in all its southern territory and its southern harbor, which is Eilat. And they start thinking about what should we do. Now that's an act of war, and it ought to be met with the same thing. One thing Egypt did wrong in this particular period of time, and they listened to the Russians. On the 5th of June 1967, at 4 o'clock in the morning, the Russian ambassador comes to Mr. Nasser and he said, please, don't start the war. Because the situation became very tense, the two armies were right neck on neck at the Gaza borders, and they were just going to jump over each other. But the Russian ambassador came with a very wise, quote-unquote, advice. Don't attack first. And that's all what the Israelis wanted. If Nasser attacked first, the war of 1967 would have never ended in 6 days. But he listened to the Russian ambassador. And at 10 o'clock in the morning, the Israelis attacked first. But how did they do it? And that was the biggest trick of all wars. They knew if they sent the 400 airplanes against Egypt the regular way, the radars would have seen the coming airplanes and they would have prepared for them. But instead of flying the regular way, they flew north of Egypt at a height of about 100 feet. And that's very dangerous over water at 100 feet for about 300 miles until they came west of Egypt. When they got west of Egypt and the radars didn't detect them, they flew up high. And they came from west, the west of Egypt, instead of coming east of Egypt. See, Israel is east of Egypt and northeast of Egypt. And this is why they had to fly very low, so they won't have to be detected by the radars of Egypt, until they reached the western part of Egypt, and then they went up high. The radars saw the airplanes. What did they think? That these were the airplanes that Algeria promised 2 days earlier to send to Egypt. So they were very happy. More airplanes coming. And when they start seeing things coming down, probably they thought they were sandwiches or something. Until they start blowing things around. And in 2 hours, all the airfields in Egypt were out of commission. All the about 400 fighting airplanes could not fly, were destroyed totally in 2 hours. The situation was so confusing that the military operators forgot to prepare the sign of Jews and prophesying that the Jews would fall by the edge of the sword and be led away captives into all nations, and Jerusalem shall be trodden down by the Gentiles until the times of the Gentiles be fulfilled. As I mentioned, we don't have the time to speak on this prophecy, maybe some other time. But this is one, and I reiterate, the most important prophecy to determine where we are today in end times. And to see why all these prophecies and these chains of events that were prophesied in the Bible are being fulfilled in this particular generation. However, Jerusalem, for the first time in 2,000 years, was regained by the Jews and was put under Jewish jurisdiction. They took even the Golan Heights. Now, I've got to tell you the story about the Golan Heights. See, when the war started on the 5th of June, I was sitting down in my home, and I had four radios right in front of me. A radio was open to Beirut, the Beirut station, and a radio to Damascus station, a radio to Tel Aviv, and a radio was tuned to Cairo. So that I would hear all the military communiques at the moment they are issued by the prospective government. And everybody was shocked when all of a sudden the Syrian radio station interrupted its music, military music, to say we have a military communique. And the military communique was that the Golan Heights were lost to the Jews. No one could believe that. The Golan Heights were so high, I mean, it takes more than 3-4 battalions to fight more than 3-4 months to take the Golan Heights. Especially the Golan Heights were very well fortified, tremendously armed. And from those Golan Heights, the Syrians were badgering the Jews day and night for years. And they couldn't take it. And now, attacking it almost from the first day after they destroyed Egypt and they turned against Syria, they took that Golan Height in one day. That was almost impossible. But we heard later that the Israelis, at the time the Golan Height was announced to have fallen to the Jews, the Israelis weren't even close to the Golan Height. We heard that the Jews were at the bottom of the hill, way down, looking up there, thinking that why were these batteries up there silenced? They thought it must have been some kind of a trap, so that the Jews would go up the hill and then they would really suck it to them from the top of the hill. For 7 hours they waited. And they start to sending scouts up there. And when the scouts arrived in there, they found the area totally abandoned, deserted. And it was 7 hours later that the Israelis came and occupied the Golan Heights. And no one have yet explained the situation in the Golan Heights. All kind of stories came up afterwards about armies that the Syrians saw up there, you know, and like the armies of Elisha, remember, in the air, that the Syrians saw. Well, the Syrians could see anything they want to anyway. So we really don't know the story, but what we know that they abandoned their positions 7 hours before the Israelis were even close to that particular situation. And they took the Golan Heights. Now, in this way, they have secured all the eastern borders of Israel, so no infiltration would be coming from the east, from the eastern borders, to try to sabotage the settlements in Israel. And they secured the Golan Heights. That way, no Syrian batteries and artilleries would badger the Jewish settlers anymore in Galilee. Now, what happened was that in 1970, One other thing resulted because of the 1967 war that you ought to know is that the Palestinian young men looked around them and they saw that the Arab armies were defeated in 6 days, that they could not anymore depend upon the regular Arab armies, that they, if anything ought to be done, it ought to be done with them doing it. And this is why the fighters in the PLO and the organizations that fought for the PLO and the Palestinian cause jumped practically from about 500 men to 50,000 men in arms in about 6 months. They decided that they would do the job themselves instead of depending upon the regular Arab armies that they thought no one could depend upon. Now, when the number of fighters grew very fast that way, and their headquarters was yet and still in Amman, Jordan, now they became very powerful in Amman. And in 1970, I was in Amman, Jordan. I was with my wife, and we used to go downtown Amman. We were there for revival meetings, and it was really scary to see young men with all kind of arms hanging all over him, with hand grenades dangling all around him like cones from a Christmas tree. And you can't but think, what happened to you if that guy blew up somehow passing by your side? What happens to you, you know? So that thought was on the mind of everybody. This is why King Hussein said, I don't want these men anymore downtown with all these arms dangling all over them. And they said, well, you don't like it, lump it. And he didn't like that answer for a king. So he said, all right, I'll lump it, all right. And he fought it out with them in 1970. About quite a few thousand people died in that war between the Jordanian army and the PLO. However, the Jordanian army won the battle and forced the Palestine Liberation Organization out of Jordan. Where did they go? To Lebanon. At that time, Lebanon was bickering the Christians and the Muslims between themselves. The Muslims want the presidency. The Christians did not want to give them the presidency. So the central government in Lebanon was very weak. Another issue that divided the Christians and the Muslims in Lebanon was the issue of the Palestinians. The Lebanese Muslims wanted to fight against Israel. And the Christians said, no, we cannot fight against Israel. Not that the Christians, and I mean by the Christians mainly Roman Catholics, they said, we cannot fight against Israel, not because that the Roman Catholics of Lebanon loved the Israelis that much. No, because Lebanon, the top secret in Lebanon was that it had only about 10,000 soldiers, but with the police and the gendarme, that's the police, like state police, they had 18,000. And their trucks, most of them were in the garage. And a few tanks to start, you need to push first. So they thought with equipment like this, they couldn't fight Israel. Israel has 250,000 soldiers ready to fight with the best equipment. And their armies were equipped as second to none in the Middle East. How in the world 18,000 armed forces, quote unquote, would fight with antiquated military hardware, would fight the most sophisticated army in the world today and at the time? So this is why the Christians refused to enter into any war in Israel. Well, I've got to tell you that. During the war of 1967, Israel occupied land from all the abutting countries that was around it. Did you know that? Syria, Jordan, and Egypt. That's from the northeast, from the east, and the south, except from Lebanon. Do you know why? They say that's a true story, though. I don't know. The only reason why they did not occupy Lebanon at that time is that the Minister of Defense during the 1967 war was Moshe Dayan. And when he was looking at the map with an eye on his left, right pack, he could only see this way. So he couldn't see on the left there, and he couldn't see Lebanon. This is why he didn't occupy Lebanon in 1967. However, the situation between the Israelis between the Christians and the Muslims weakened the central government to the extent that the PLO could go down to southern Lebanon and find that they have a good haven for them there to infiltrate it through the borders or take from southern Lebanon the boats to western Israel and do their suicidal missions. That aggravated the Jews to no end. Especially, and that's very important, especially between 1976 and 1980, practically there were more Jews leaving Israel than those who were going to Israel. And that frustrated the government of Israel to no end. Because the Jewish young men were very much frustrated that the situation is always tense, that suicidal attack was there, that they had to be ready to fight at any time. They were living on their nerves, and they couldn't take that anymore. And this is why they left Israel, mostly coming to the United States of America. And that frustrated Israeli government to no end. However, for the Israelis to prove that they would like to have peace with the Arabs, the moment they heard one day in 1977 that Mr. Sadat was talking with Mr. Cronkite, and Sadat said that for the sake of peace he would be ready to go to Israel, the Israelis jumped on the occasion immediately and he said, "Okay, come. We're ready to do anything just to have peace with other southern neighbors." See, there were some kind of pamphlets that have been distributed in the Arab world for a long period of time that any Arab leader that would sign a peace treaty with Israel would be signing the papers and the affidavit for his execution. And I read some of those particular papers. They were being distributed in the streets. And that was way before even Sadat thought about signing a peace treaty with Israel. But Sadat thought that the only way to regain his lost piece of land, which is a huge piece of land, the Sinai, was not by declaring war against Israel. He could realize and recognize that the United States would not allow Israel to have a second-rate army, or allow its army to be second to anybody. And he realized that there would be no way of regaining his land except by negotiations and by peace. And he said, "If that's the only way, and I would like to have my piece of land back, I better negotiate peace." Especially at the time, you may not realize that Israel found a tremendous amount of oil in the Sinai. Just to give you an idea, an average oil well in the United States produces 10 barrels a day of oil. The oil well they discovered in Sinai produced an average daily production of 23,000 barrels a day. That's a lot of oil. So he thought, well, if I have a peace treaty with Israel, I'll take all this back, and I'll be in better condition than fighting a war for it. Especially because he tried in 1973. See, he wanted to regain the land. He thought that if he followed first in the beginning, he said, I am following the policies of Nasser. But he found out later that the policies of Nasser are disastrous. And because he said, I am following the policies of Nasser, he almost destroyed himself. And he said he would declare war in 1972, and he didn't. And he lost his popularity in his own country. This is why he was forced to secretly prepare for the Yom Kippur War of 1973 and attack Israel. Even though he lost the war, really, but it was a tremendous victory for the Egyptians to know that they crossed the canal finally, even though they were trapped and almost were massacred. But it was, in a way, a tremendous moral victory. And it was ironic that on the 6th of October, a few years later, celebrating the Yom Kippur War and his quote-unquote victory, Sadat was assassinated. Now, because of the negotiation between Israel and Egypt, the Camp David peace treaty was signed. But you have to understand one thing here, though. The Israelis understood that really what they are signing is an agreement not with Egypt, but with one man called Anwar al-Sadat. And they were always worried what would happen if Anwar al-Sadat dies. What would happen to the peace treaty? Would it evaporate? Almost did. And it's almost evaporating. Why? Because now in Egypt, there are the mullahs who are very fanatic Muslims, who do not like the present regime and who never liked Mr. Sadat. They are being put in jail now at a rate of about 100 a week or so. They are in like in a revolving door into the prison. They can't come in and out. Because every Friday they preach against Nasser, against the government of Egypt. Sadat put many of them in the prison. Then this president, when he came, he got them out. Now he put them back in because they're preaching against him. But what they're saying is that what happened in Iran against the Shah will happen here in Egypt. Therefore, they say that time is on their side. Now, Israel thought that they paid a very high price for that peace with their southern neighbors, the Egyptians, by giving back the Sinai, by giving the riches they found in the Sinai, by abandoning the cities or destroying the cities that they built in the Sinai, the gardens they created in the Sinai. They left all that because they thought that they would have permanent and lasting peace in the Middle East. Now, Israel always wanted peace. This is why they fought the wars. This is why they fought the war of 1982, to secure the peace of their northern settlers. And they did. And as a matter of fact, for the first time in the history of Israel, now they have security throughout its borders. They secured the peace with their southern neighbors, the Egyptians, by taking the West Bank and securing it to the natural border of the Jordan River. They secured and could monitor all movements in that area so there would be no infiltration into Egypt, into Israel, by any sabotage workers. And in 1982, they destroyed destroyed all the military structure of the PLO, and they combed it out and they cleared it. And this is why the northern settlers in Israel are secure today. As a matter of fact, the Prime Minister of Israel in October of 1982 stood up in the Knesset, which is the Congress of Israel, saying that this time, for the first time in the history of Israel, today we can say that we have security and peace within our borders for the first time. But listen, the Bible said in Ezekiel chapter 38 that when Israel considered itself as unwalled villages, what's the meaning of unwalled villages? Why do we have walled villages? Why do we have walls? Why do we have doors and gates? We have doors, we lock them, not because we think it's nice decoration, because we don't want someone to come and clean the house while we're away, huh? Clean it from everything. Because we don't have security. We don't have peace of mind leaving the house unlocked and unchained and not what. People put walls and gates because there is no security. When there are no gates and no walls, means there is security. As a matter of fact, that is one thing that fascinated me when I first came to the United States of America in 1967. And I was in a small little town in Indiana, and I was staying with a family there, and we were going out, all of us, and they just shut the door behind us. I said to my host, I said, "Sir, you didn't lock the door." He said, "Here, we don't lock doors." And I thought, that is all over the United States. They don't lock doors. And I rode back to Lebanon. Said, "You can't believe it. In the United States, they don't lock doors." See, I never visited anyone in New York, for example, to see all these locks from the top of the door to the bottom. I would have thought maybe that's just a decoration or something. But that's in that town, they were so secure, there is security and peace enough, that they wouldn't have to, in 1967 that is, to lock the doors. And the Bible says that in the end time, Israel, when it is born, it would live in peace. It would live in fear for a long period of time. That Israel would live in fear, even though they go back and possess the land, yet they would live in fear. And they did. They lived in fear until the time when they would declare that they live in securely and in peace. And in October 1982, after they cleared southern Lebanon and secured the rest of the borders, they said now to the Jews, "Come back to Israel. Now you can live in peace. You don't have to be scared anymore." Let's read that in Ezekiel chapter 38, that particular verse. And verse 11. "And thou shalt say, I will go up to the land of unwalled villages. I will go to those who are at rest, who dwell safely, all of them dwelling without walls and having neither bars nor gates." For the first time, Israel is dwelling safely. Do you know what that means? For the first time, Russia has now the opportunity wide open to fulfill the prophecy for the first time in history. Do you think it's by a coincidence that Syria has allowed 5,000 Russian experts to be on its soil manning missile sites, the SS-21 and the SAM-5 that can reach 185 miles inside Israel? That means now the Russians and the Israelis are on the front line. And this peace, the Bible says, will not last for long. When the Jews finally would say, we have attained peace and safety, the Bible says, sudden destruction comes. This has never been fulfilled before. And for the first time, these things are being fulfilled in the course of history. To tell us, beyond any shadow of a doubt, that we are living in the last days. You consider yourself in a court and a jury, and the evidence is right here. From the Bible and from history. I'm not giving anything that is top secret. You can review that in any newspaper or magazine or history book, recent history books. To show us that we are living in the last days. And this is why as Christians, we better clean our act and our relationship with the Lord. And I really mean that. Because the Lord Himself shall descend from heaven with a shout, with the voice of the archangel, the trump of God, the devil.